This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. With me this week, Miss Helen Needham.
And we're standing outside in the city of Aberdeen and the rain is falling.
It's cold and it's grey and it's dreary, which is strange because this week there's been some absolutely beautiful weather and, more importantly, signs of spring.
Yes, and I've really got the urge to get out into the garden and start digging and growing things and so on.
Yeah, well, I must say, I started weeding the garden yesterday, not to say that it was overdue, but it's a machete I need more than anything else.
Yeah.
But I saw something the other day I've never seen before in my life, and I saw it by accident. I came round the corner of one of our buildings and there were two robins sitting on the fence.
You don't often see two together, do you?
No, but this was a male and a female. Mm. And the male was trying to woo the female, and this is the bit I'd never seen before. Pushing its head right up, twisting its neck round in a very sort of sinuous way.
Ah.
And I watched it for a while, and then it caught sight of me out the corner of its eye and went, oh! You know, and it was as if, for all the world, that robin looked at me as if I was intruding on something
private. You're a
peeping
Tom.
Exactly. It had that look on its face. And the female flew off first, and the male sort of stood and looked at me and went, yeah, you're not worth it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, mate.
Thanks, pal. I was that close. That close. Too late now. Anyway, if you're looking for something to do in about the Glasgow area, here is a fantastic suggestion. Many, many years ago, I used to live in the south side of Glasgow, and I would commute to where I lived using Glasgow's Central Station. It is a fabulous piece of Victorian design. Wonderful piece of thing. Living example how a building evolves over time to accommodate social changes. A company called Glasgow Central Tours offer folk the chance to see parts of the station that aren't normally open to the public, and learn how this building has been at the heart of the city's history for over 140 years now. I met up with tour guide Jackie Ogilvie on the main concourse.
So on the 1st of August 1879, Central Station opened her doors. The original build was created by a man called Robert Rowand Anderson, a very distinguished architect. And then the extension and the refurbishment of Central Station was carried out by the architect James Miller, a man who probably doesn't get the publicity of some of his contemporaries. He was around at the same time as Charles Rennie Mackintosh, and he created this part of the station. We're just walking through now into the extension, the new part of Central Station, which is very much defined by the blonde sandstone pillars here, and then going through the green pillars right through between platform 9 and 10. The roof is the absolute key, longitudinal for the original part, the 1879 part, and latitudinal and curved, Queen Anne style girders in the extension.
We are at the end of tracks 10 and 11 at the moment. There are these huge buffers, I mean massive pieces of industrial engineering. Basically, hydraulic pistons with rams at the far end. So if the train did, you know, the brakes failed for whatever reason, they'd slam into this and it would decelerate, and it'd still be pretty messy, but it'd certainly be a lot better than hitting a solid brick wall.
These are 1906 buffers.
Wow.
So there are five
still
sets, still functioning, very much functional. So there are five sets left of the original 13 from 1906.
I wonder how much stuff we're putting in nowadays that's still going to be functional in 114 years. Yeah. Precious little, I suspect.
And how many buildings are we putting up that will still be here in 140?
Not many. Not many.
Probably not. This is us starting to go underneath the station.
Why is it warm?
This particular part is probably the warmest part of the station, and it's because there's no exposure whatsoever to the outside world, other than when the door opens and closes. So one thing to remember about Central Station underneath, whilst it has its history, it is very much a working station. Vehicles travel back and forward in here. We have storage facilities for all the retail outlets. When this was built, this was a whole series of arches.
It's beautifully built, actually. It's fabulous brickwork, painted in red and white now. But, you know, the skill involved in this.
They first of all built a wooden arch.
Mm-hmm.
That was the framework.
Yeah.
On top of that, they would put brick upon brick.
Yeah.
Then they would take away the wooden frame.
I've often wondered about that. What that was actually like, just pulling the last stick away.
Yeah. Is it going to work? Yeah. And it seems to have worked. And it's not the Victorians that invented this. The Romans.
They're the ones that invented
this form. It's self-supporting.
Yeah.
It took over 10 million Glasgow bricks to build this station, which is quite an incredible piece of workmanship.
And you can see right out to the street there just now.
Yeah, that's Hope Street there. This is the old Red Star parcel drop-off and pick-up point. People used to be able to come in here.
Oh, this is interesting. Holidays, Scottish Fjords. Basically, there's a series of murals on the wall.
These were commissioned by a contractor who was working in the station about 7 or 8 years ago, refurbishing the platforms as they wanted to distract people's attention away from the inconvenience that was being caused by the work. They commissioned the beautiful murals that we have, and they were painted by students from Glasgow School of Art. Talk about the red railings here. This is because this used to be where the travelling post office would be fed.
Right.
So the mail that was coming onto the travelling post office would come up these stairs and be loaded on at platform 10 to the train that would travel overnight. And of course, on the 8th of August 1963, the most famous travelling post office left Central Station, and that was to become have a starring role in the Great Train Robbery.
Indeed.
And most Glaswegians know about the Great Train Robbery. What they don't realise is that she
started off from Glasgow Central Station.
Yeah. She started from Glasgow Central Station.
See, if somebody had asked me, I would have said that was the music for E.T.
Well, I'm sure it's the music for The Great Train Robbery because I did some research on that. If I'm wrong, I'm prepared to put my hands up.
Yeah,
you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Was it John Williams that did the music for E.T.? I'm not sure.
It could well be. He did a lot of film music, didn't he?
You're listening to Scotland Outdoors, one of the most partially informed podcasts possibly on the internet at the moment. We're not terribly certain about anything this week.
Well, I don't think anyone's certain about anything. There is no certainty in our world anymore.
Well, there's a deep and philosophical thought.
It's true,
when you least
though.
Expected it.
I know you like to be kept on your toes. We're just offering a bit of respite, aren't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, that too with Jackie Ogilvie, you stick with this podcast because, coming up in that, she took me down to what was a Victorian platform that had been bricked up and they reopened it again. But again, you can't normally get at that bit.
Yeah.
But cracking thing to do.
You were like a kid in a sweetie shop.
I was. What? Yeah, well, you hear it. Earlier this week on Monday, I was in Aviemore for a conference organised by the Cairngorm National Park Authority. And it was looking at how we can use nature and natural things to mitigate the effects of climate change. Very interesting idea. In the title of the conference was the phrase net zero. Net zero is the point where the same volume of greenhouse gases are being emitted, are being absorbed through offsetting techniques like forestry. Now, nobody's in any doubt that it's going to be, well, it's not going to be easy to actually achieve net zero. Lots of things are going to have to change, not least the way we use land. Chris Stark is chief executive of the Committee on Climate Change, and he explained why.
The way we use land at the moment, which of course is in large part determined by the way in which we set policies for the use of that land, is not compatible with a net zero future. So put simply, we have to look at the way we use land and use it differently so that we can get to net zero overall. Now, net zero is not just a slogan. It's a scientific certainty. So globally, we have to reach the point where we have reached net zero emissions. And at that point, we will stop warming the planet's atmosphere. And here in Scotland, there is a huge task to bring that about. It involves changing slightly, I would say, the way we use land. Perfectly achievable thing overall. But we have to look at, in particular, agricultural practice and freeing up land so that we can store carbon more naturally in the ground and in trees.
You say it involves changing it slightly. Scottish farmers may disagree. You spoke about taking a fifth of the land, you know, agricultural land, out of traditional use and doing what with it?
Well, put simply, if we can free up what's presently traditional agricultural land, then we can use it in a different way, in particular to improve the woodland cover of the country and also to the really important challenge in Scotland of restoring peatland. That does, I'm afraid, mean that we have to look at the way we use land at present. So we're talked about in our scenarios freeing up, as you say, a fifth of agricultural land. Actually, by mid-century, the numbers of livestock haven't changed too much, only a 10% fall in numbers of sheep and cows across the UK. But that is not going to be an easy challenge overall. And crucially, we don't have the policies in place to drive that at the moment. So this is where we look to the government, particularly as we've left now the European Union. We are freed up to consider a world after the Common Agricultural Policy. We can think, I think, now of a set of Scottish-focused policies that bring about a net zero use of land by mid-century.
You spoke too about a shift in diet.
Yes, that's right. So the underpinning of this is, again, a small shift in diet. Our scenario has a 20% fall in our consumption of red meat and dairy, for example. You can think of that as a minimum. And what I presented today to the conference was that this isn't something that you can simply offshore. So we do have to see a change in diet, otherwise we won't free up the land. And secondly, we cannot see a situation where we import that meat rather than produce it. Here in Scotland, we produce some of the lowest greenhouse gas intensity of meat anywhere in the world. It is high-quality meat, and we can continue to eat it, of course. So it's about eating a little bit less, but eating more quality. If we offshore the problem, if we import that meat instead of producing it here in Scotland, it comes from places with really high damaging impacts. So Indonesia, Brazil, for example, places that are presently forested. We'll be knocking down those trees to create the grassland to graze the animals. That's a terrible outcome from all sorts of perspectives. So the question of diet does, I'm afraid, sit at the heart of this question overall.
You spoke to about Scottish agriculture's resistance to change. I mean, particularly the use of things like fossil fuels, etc. Do the alternatives currently exist that to allow them to change?
The alternatives do exist, but crucially, they only need to exist over the next 10, 20 years. So this is about pointing in the right direction. And when I say that agriculture is resistant to change, what I don't mean is the sector itself. I mean that the emissions from agriculture haven't changed tremendously over recent years. So what I would like to see happen is a discussion of climate and having a discussion with the farming community about their stewardship of the land in a way that is compatible with our climate objectives overall. And you could think of carbon as a new crop. That's a really important way into this. We're talking not just about creating a difficult set of circumstances for agriculture, but potentially an even better set of circumstances overall. But we're going to have to broaden the scope of what we mean by agriculture to broaden, you know, in particular, the growing of trees.
How many more trees are we going to need on an annual basis? What's the minimum?
Well, across the UK, it's hard to know precisely in Scotland what the figure is, but across the UK, we're talking about increasing planting rates to levels they were at the end of the 70s and early 80s. Now, that is a tremendous challenge. Across the UK, from 2024 onwards, we're talking about planting 100 million trees a year. That sounds like a lot. But it is a lot, but it's something we've done before. In fact, we've been at higher rates even than that. So this is something that we can gear up for. We have to have the right nurseries to supply those trees. We have to be prepared to plant them in the right places. We have to have the right standards for growing trees in the right places and make sure those trees are the right trees. But all of this is possible. But it won't happen, of course, unless we have strong policies to drive towards that. I'm encouraged by what's happening in Scotland. We have good policies for tree plantation and good policies for restoring peatland. That's the other really important way of storing carbon in the land. And, you know, we need to keep that up. So that's the challenge overall.
You spoke about feed-in tariffs for planting trees. It's such a clever idea. I mean, right now you can get it for, you know, photovoltaics or small-scale hydro schemes, but not planting trees. It's clever.
It is clever, but it's also borrowing from something we know very well from the energy sector. It works, exactly. And remember, it is a similar outcome that we're trying to achieve here. So this is about understanding that when you grow a tree or when you restore peatland, you are storing carbon and there is a value to society for that. And what we've suggested in our report earlier this year was that there are market-based ways to do this, in particular by having a feed-in tariffs where the land manager would be rewarded for storing that carbon by planting those trees or by restoring the peatland. And we can conceive of ways to do that, but crucially, we can fund it by taxing the use of fossil fuels in the first place, so repairing the damage that has been done by that fossil fuel use. That would allow us then to take the pressure off public spending more generally, so we can use public spending more directly for improving the environment, supporting the steps that need to be taken elsewhere through less market-based mechanisms. And it's perfectly achievable. We will need to design that well, of course. We have to have the appropriate protections in place. And again, we do need to be growing the right things in the right places. But that seems to me that could be a new avenue for land managers and farmers. Again, I hope that the community is open to that suggestion because it's really important that we get on track.
Remember, roughly this time last year, standing in the car park, the cairn and the car park at the top of the Cairn Mount, and looking across the Angus Glens and seeing these plumes of smoke coming off grouse moss, essentially muir burn, burning off the old heather to encourage the growth of the new stuff. How long do you think that will be allowed to continue?
Well, we were quite strong in our recommendations earlier this year that something has to be done about this. In and of itself, that practice is not damaging. It is, however, damaging when it dries out the peatland. And I'm afraid that's what's been happening. So we have recommended a ban on that practice. I could conceive of alternatives through this, but they need to be harder-edged regulatory measures. We haven't seen, you might call them more voluntary measures, work. Now, this is, I know,
legislation and
a harder-edged approach to this, because it is one of the most damaging things we can do to peatland, to dry it out and effectively end its capacity to store that carbon. We shouldn't have to be having this discussion. So this is an important step, and it ties, of course, to some very important societal and social questions. But the burning of what's presently grouseland is not compatible with that net zero overall. We're going to have to find a tougher-edged approach to this.
One of the last things you said in your presentation was you don't like the term climate emergency. Why not?
Well, I think calling it a climate emergency is of course the position. I accept entirely that this is an emergency, but it's not the way that many people perceive it in society, and therefore I find it more appealing to refer to it as a climate choice.
Less alarmist.
Well, it's less alarmist, but it's also, I think, it throws better light on the topic. So We cannot escape the choice. So either we tackle this, cut our emissions and arrest the increase in temperatures globally that we're seeing at the moment, or we don't, and we have a different set of things to deal with, much, much more expensive and damaging societal transitions that we're going to have to deal with. Either way, we have to do something about climate change. We either adapt to it or we try and tackle it up front. And I much prefer framing it as a choice like that, because when you do so, it's obvious which of those choices you should take.
Chris Starr, Chief Executive of the Committee on Climate Change.
I'd be very keen to hear from people living in other countries, actually, about the approach, because this idea of 15% of productive farmland being used to plant trees is something that is obviously quite a major shift for farmers and land managers, but perhaps completely necessary.
Could be. I mean, the idea of farmers getting paid in future for delivering public goods, one of which might be mitigation of, you know, climate change, fair enough. I must confess I am instinctively nervous about taking productive land out of food production and putting it into something else, because history has shown us that there are times when you actually need that food. You know, you can't always transport it in from other countries. But, you know, let us know, seriously, let us know what you're actually doing in your country to sort of try and address the same issues, because Scotland's not the only country in the world that's
worried about this. We're not alone. And actually, somebody got in touch with the live programme earlier and said, what about all the grouse moorland?
Yeah.
There's a lot of land there that is currently being used for that purpose. could it be used for planting trees?
I don't know. Certainly there are scientists looking into that at the moment from the James Hutton Institute. Not so much climate, but just general winter conditions. This is probably not the time of year that I would instinctively head towards a beach and run into the water.
Really? Why ever not?
I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just strange that way. But, you know, I'm trying to think. A couple of summers ago, it was the ferry at Glen Elgin. You know the one where they push the platform round? You drive the car on and they physically push the platform round so that the cars are sideways and off it goes.
That's the wee ferry to Skye.
That's the one. I got onto the other side of the ferry crossing and then suddenly realised that I didn't have to be in my next location for a couple of hours. It was a beautiful summer's afternoon and every other car had disappeared and there's nobody on that side. There was nobody about. I thought, I've got a wetsuit in the back of the car. I could go into the water, but you've got to be really careful there because the current's really quite ferocious. So what I was doing was walking about 150 metres up the coast, going into the water and then just letting the side bit of the current, which is much gentler, carry me down, you know. So I was basically just hovering, floating over sort of bladder rack, all sorts of things, and there was fish moving in and out and crabs and all sorts of interesting stuff. Snorkeling is good fun.
Yeah, and it's so absorbing.
Oh,
isn't
yeah.
It?
Too straight. The Scottish Wildlife Trust has created a set of award-winning snorkel trails just to try and illustrate to folk best places to go to. 9 of the sites are in the Northwest Highlands. So we get to the point eventually. Ewan McElraith headed to Ullapool to hear more about them. Not to go into the water, you understand, because it's freezing. That would be stupid. But he spoke to Noel Hawkins, Living Seas Communities Manager for the Scottish Wildlife Trust.
Originally, it was just as straightforward as the fact that I had a dry suit. I'm involved with a group. We go out and do whale and dolphin rescue. My friend said he was seeing some pretty amazing stuff around Grignard Beach, quite close to us. I hadn't been snorkelling since Australia. Thought it was a crazy idea in the Highlands due to the weather.
You can see the point.
Well, at the moment, as we're standing here with snow around us, yeah, it doesn't seem sort of ideal snorkel territory. We get to a lovely balmy 13 degrees, and some of the sights we see, I've had people from Australia out with me. They work in the Barrier Reef. It's obviously a different thing they see, but they're actually very enthusiastic about the rich biodiversity and the clarity in the waters around here.
And it's kind of wonderful, you know, if you do get a decent hood on so your head's not freezing. But you know, snorkeling, it's just free to go. It's, you know, it's a cheap sport.
It is. It's very accessible. It's. I mean, I love diving, but you know, everyone that dives knows about. You know, you're lumping stuff about and a bit of a rigmarole at times. Where so you can have the kit in the boot of your car, see a nice beach as you're driving past, and jump in. Obviously, safety considerations. We do have to be quite aware of that. You know, you don't go in where it's busy, boats about. But that's why we decided to do a trail. We looked at specific sites that offered an opportunity for families as well as adults and that to go in. A lot of the kids locally we've trained up in conjunction with BSAC, dolphin snorkelers. They train up and they get the basics and, you know, duck diving, how to clear the masks and that. We've trained about 70 kids in Ullapool and Lochinvernay. And we've had over 100 kids out in the sea actually, and they love it. And getting hands-on and actually seeing the stuff under the seas makes it a lot easier to explain why we need to conserve it and the benefits of it.
Now, when Mark spoke to you, I think it was the Eyemouth Trail that you were launching, but it's taken legs and running now, isn't it?
It has. I mean, it started off just in Northwest Highlands. It was Harris we actually went to afterwards. They had a ranger that was very enthusiastic about snorkeling, I think partially due to a scallop addiction. And then Eyemouth came in with the Marine Reserve. We were just back actually last week down speaking with Coast on Arran. Arran's a beautiful location with it, and with Lamlish having a no-take zone and everything, it would be a great one to integrate.
So would you be able to snorkel within that no-take zone? This is an area in the Bay, which is for protection of marl, the kind of cold water coral, but you're not allowed to go and take anything from there.
We're going to try and find half a dozen sites, and if it's feasible, go ahead with that. So there's one that's possibly in there, one in the MPA, and a couple of others around the coast. We're also speaking to the Inner Isles, University Highlands and Islands, we've been in discussion for a while, and the Seabird Centre, so there's a number of potential partners, and we're open to ideas from everyone around the coast. Long term, I'd love to see this become a network all the way around Scotland, including Orkney in Shetland, if anyone wants to get in touch from up there.
Are they expensive things to set up, though?
Health and safety is obviously a consideration, so we go and check the sites, have a look, see that not only are they health and safety compliant, but there's stuff of interest. We don't want to just send you in on a bare beach, you know. Once we've got that, we usually narrow it down to a number of sites, depending on the if you want hard copy leaflets. They can be printed off. That's actually one of the biggest costs. We've got a template now for leaflets. We're just in the process of developing a website too that we hope will include all the snorkel trails. So the costs are fairly minimal. And what we're more looking for is a partner in the area that will keep an eye on the things, because obviously I don't want to be going and checking the beaches every couple of days or so all around Scotland. So it's a partner group that will look after it in the areas and work with us hand in hand.
I'm going to try it in the summer. Certainly not going to try it today, as the snow piles down here on the west coast. But what kind of things can you see?
There's a lot of life. My personal favourites are up rocky outcrops with kelp on it. We had a big kelp campaign just last year when it was threatened with dredging, and part of the reason was because we see the benefits, you know, up close. If you go into kelp, you get juvenile fish, sea urchins, dogfish, crabs, you name it, it's there, you know, and it's a very diverse culture living in the kelp. It was described as a monoculture by some of the people proposing kelping it, and it's about as fast away from that as you can get. It's like a mini rainforest, and it's literally a few steps off a beach.
For me, watching hermit crabs swapping shells and chasing each other and trying to get new houses and making the mistake and dying, I could just sit and watch that for hours.
Yeah, for sure. I had one down just at the ferry ramp at the pier in Ullapool. Went in there, and when the ferry comes in, it's a big beast of a boat and blasts it twice a day, you know. Didn't expect to be much there, but if you just sit quietly and watch, suddenly this life just all springs out, the stones and shale all around the pier, the bed, you know, the shrimps, hermit crabs, they're always funny, and the multitude of life, and it's quite impressive to watch. But a lot of people go in and thrash about, and I think that sort of scares everything off, and it is, I find it quite therapeutic, just sort of floating about quietly and watching. It's pretty nice.
It's one of the great untapped tourism potentials as well in Scotland.
I think so. That's what we're hoping down at Eyemouth. They're sort of looking ahead to this and trying to get instructors involved. There's a lad around Gerloch, he's actually been offering tours on his boat, and you know, it's an accessory. It's not dependent on snorkel trails, obviously, but it's another thread in the bow sort of thing. And I do think for the costs, it's way more accessible than diving, so for people wanting to get a start, it may well lead on to diving too. So
and kind of puts the ocean environment, the coastal environment on the map. If you can see the wildlife, then you care.
That's been the inspiration from the start. You know, I mean, we've got a marine protected area here at Ullapool, the West of Ross MPA, and you know, you stand and look at it, and it doesn't actually mean a lot to people. You're just looking at water, basically. You know, although it's just, you know, pretty in the summer isles, but when you get underneath and you see, you know, the kelp environment, the Merle, there's actually one of the islands out in the summer isles where you can swim above the Merle, and you suddenly understand what it is. It's an intricate network of, you know, this Scottish coral, as it was known. You know, and there's so much life in it. And at the moment, we're actually scouting about looking for herring. Herring's been returning in lochs around here, and where it returns is where there's historical merle beds. We think that's what's attracting them. They can lay their eggs. So once you start building up this picture of how it's all interconnected and the importance of protecting one thing to look after potentially 20 others, you know, it makes it a lot easier to understand that. And it is, that first step is just getting in and taking a look.
Noel Hawkins there, Living Seas Communities Manager for the Scottish Wildlife Trust. And I do like snorkelling. Actually, I just like being in the water.
Yes. You are a bit of a water person, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, but, you know, and I have been in during the winter time, but you just kind of need to get into the right mental attitude. In a wetsuit, you're okay.
Yeah.
For a while, anyway.
Yeah.
It's difficult to snorkel in a dry suit. I've tried that.
Right. What happened?
But, well, it inflates in the strangest places.
Right.
And it kind of tips you into various funny angles and things like that. It's much easier on a wetsuit. You do have to wear a weight belt to sort of counteract the whole thing. But it's possible, not desirable,
yeah.
But possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, snorkelling, we know we have listeners to this podcast all over the world. Let us know where you go snorkelling. I imagine it's significantly warmer than the west coast of
Scotland.
Not
necessarily, it might be worse.
outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Let's go back to Glasgow Central Station now. There are two main stations in Glasgow, Glasgow Queen Street and Glasgow Central. Glasgow Central is Victorian. It's fabulous building, thriving transport hubs used by tens of thousands of people every day. But I got the chance to go behind the scenes at Glasgow Central Station and learn more about its history with tour guide Jackie Ogilvie.
Oh wow, what a smell of damp when you come through that door. Fusty.
Yes, definitely fusty. It's always my description for in here.
Yeah.
There's an old saying when you're in the city of Glasgow that you should always look up to enjoy it. I think in this station it's very much relevant as well. Yeah. Partly because of the breeze block, because the breeze block, it kind of confuses you and fools you into thinking that this is maybe, you know, small corridors. But when you look up, you can see the girders, the arches, It's the constant arches. The arches are really what are holding up Central Station.
I can hear a rumbling above me. Is that the train?
These are trains, absolutely. Under here, this is the Healingman's umbrella.
Is it, by Jove?
Central Station Bridge crosses over Argyle Street during the clearances, about over 20,000. Highland, Gaelic-speaking Highlanders came to Glasgow. They were chased from their homes, either that or they faced murder, and they were replaced on their land by thousands and thousands of sheep. So they came to Glasgow looking for jobs, and we had plenty of jobs because we had engineering works up in the north of the city, but 60 shipyards on a 10-mile stretch in this city. But the jobs weren't for farmers, they were for engineers, they were for riveters, they were for shipbuilders. So when they came here, they did not have great opportunities to begin with. They lived in horrific conditions. St. Columba's Gaelic Church was on Hope Street. The Gaelic-speaking Highlanders would come down Hope Street and they would gather under Central Station Bridge. They would gather for shelter initially, because the weather back then wasn't any better than it is today. They would gather because word started to get about, so people who were looking for labourers, a couple of days casual work, they would come and they would ask, do you want to work for a couple of days? They would also gather to meet with friends and family, but the most important reason, they just wanted to talk the Gaelic.
Speak their own language.
And this is why they came. So it became a gathering place for the Highlanders, and affectionately known as the Healingman's Umbrella. So that's up above us just now is the...
Extraordinary.
Yeah. Central Station played a huge part in the war for Glaswegians, both in World War I and in World War II.
Am I right in thinking that part of this was converted into a morgue at one stage?
Where we're standing just now was used as a temporary mortuary at the very beginning of World War I. At the very beginning of World War I, repatriation of the fallen was the done thing. Unfortunately, the government discovered it was very costly. World War I wasn't really a war. It was a massacre of men from all sides. And the cost of bringing these bodies back was just beyond anyone's expectation. In 1914, they introduced non-repatriation, which stayed with us right through the two wars, right through to 1982.
Which is why,
Falklands War.
Why you have all those cemeteries in places
exactly.
like the Somme, just
yes,
thousands and thousands of
absolutely.
White crosses.
Yes. So here was used as a temporary mortuary just between 1913 and 1914. And they were brought down here. They would arrive at Platform 1 and they would be wrapped just in woolen blankets, roughly, brought down here, no wounds dressed. And many of them had taken quite some time to get here, so rot was beginning to set in. Were brought down here and laid out in stretchers just to wait for the women to come back to the station to claim their men and their boys to take them home. Big part of this was identification in the early days. They didn't have ID tags on the soldiers, and so these women would come down here and
so they'd
horrific.
Have to go through all the bodies here to try and figure out which one.
Well, the smart women would start. If their men fought in one of the Highland regiments, during World War I, these Highland regiments, so they fought in the trenches in their kilts. They died in their kilts. Mm-hmm. And they were brought to Central Station in their kilts.
What a terrible thought.
It is. It's quite horrific. So we try to do it justice here. We try to commemorate them in a very, I think, quite moving. And it's amazing when you talk about the stories that we tell around the wars. It's amazing how it touches people who have real, not first-hand experience, because we're too far on now, but second, third-hand experience from aunts, from grandpas, from great-grandpas. The stories that have been passed through the families, very much a key part of Glasgow's life. We can't shirk away from these. They're not pretty stories, but we can't shirk away from them because it's what makes us what we are today. It's what makes this station what it is today. So we're now in the lower level and we're going to head down to what was part of the lower level before the beaching report was implemented. So what we're going to do is go down to our Victorian platform.
Wow.
So if you
okay.
go in there, just mind your head on that second
door. Oh, listen, I always bang my head off stuff. Good grief. This is fabulous. Again, huge, huge riveted beams. Everything is black. It's smoke blackened. It's soot. As you know, this is back from the time when the trains were actually all steam trains and things. And there's an entire flipping platform down here.
The whole lower level was all closed off. Both what is today platform in 16 and 17, all closed off. And then in 1979, 16 and 17 were reopened.
Gonna skate round the corner. We are looking up, you know, where the platform is. The track curls round towards the right. It's just an open tunnel mouth at the far end, and we actually saw the train, the other side of that wall, passing the end of the tunnel.
Yes.
Oh, this is fab. This
is the bit that gets most creative people's juices flowing. Right. It's wonderful. And it is like taking a step back in time.
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, even things like those pillars, you know, that holding the beams up, those pillars, I'm fairly certain, are cast iron.
Yes,
huge pieces of work.
And I would say to any of your listeners who use the lower level,
right,
take a moment just before, when you're in Central Station and going down to the lower level, take a moment before you go off that last step going down to the platforms, look left and right, and you'll see pillars just like these. But they're painted a very different colour. They're painted, I think it's a kind of blue and grey. They're painted a kind of petrol blue, if I remember correctly.
Glasgow Central tour guide Jackie Ogilvie there. That underground platform, the one that we bricked over, is fabulous. But I said to her, how difficult would it be to get an old steam train in here and just park it up? You wouldn't need to move it backwards and forwards and things. It wouldn't need to be fully functional.
Just to have it there.
Well, see if you've got effects on it and things.
Yeah.
Different kinds of lighting and smoke drifting out of it and steam coming out. You know, what a draw that would be.
It would be great. And even just the smell of going into those old carriages.
Yes, aye. Yeah.
That's evocative in itself.
Very, very, very. Anyway, thoroughly recommend those tours of Glasgow Central Station. You will see parts of the station that you never get a chance to see otherwise.
We're going to bring you a midweek podcast this week.
Indeed.
Focusing in on Bothies, actually, and a chat that I had with Jeff Allen, who's written the Scottish Bothy Bible. That was a couple of years ago, but he's just brought out another book called Scottish Bothy Walks, which gets the heart racing.
Which links up the various Bothies and things like that.
Or he just suggests 28 different walks involving Bothies. Some of them are day walks, some of them are more adventurous.
What do you fancy?
Well, I quite fancy the one into Noidart.
Aye. Well, it'll be 2 days.
Yes.
Mm.
Yep. So it's one of those books that you could sit at home and look at and think, I just want to go there now.
As you creep ever closer to the fire.
Exactly. So that's our midweek podcast this week.
Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. And from all the team here, myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham, everybody working in the studio, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.